Next up, Darchamal on the Free Gaza Flotilla, oil dangers in Canada, theft of Baghdad's culture, and more. We're joined here with Darchamal. Welcome, Dar.
Thanks for having me.
This week, we had a series of events going on related to BP in Israel. Let's start first off with the flotilla. Do you know how far off the coast of Israel this took place?
Well, all the reporting that I've seen is that it took place about 65 to 70 kilometers off the coast, which is far, far out in international waters.
And what are the legal standards there?
Well, the legal standards are that, there's, according to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, Part 7, Article 87, there's a freedom of navigation. Article 88, the high seas shall be reserved for peaceful purposes. Article 89, no state may validly purport to subject any part of the high seas to its sovereignty. Article 90, every state, whether coastal or landlocked, has the right to sail ships flying its flags on the high seas. So that's just a few articles according to the Geneva Conventions that give the flotilla every right to be sailing in the high seas, particularly when they're carrying 700 peace activists, 35 members of parliaments from 15 different countries, and loaded down with nothing but humanitarian supplies.
And specifically, there were some supplies that were listed in some of the releases that were talking about, for instance, concrete and some other materials. Do you know a little bit about this and why maybe they made note of that?
Well, yes, because basically this was a flotilla whose stated objective was to break through the Israeli blockade to get the supplies into the starving people of Gaza. So the supplies that we're seeing they're loaded down with are things like wheelchairs, school books for kids, different types of food supplies, different kinds of medical supplies, bags of concrete, other building materials. All of this type of material that either has either been entirely prohibited or almost completely prohibited by the state of Israel from being allowed into the people of Gaza. This is a three-year-old blockade and counting, and it's one of the more severe blockades in modern times. And people in Gaza are literally starving. As Dov Weinglass said a couple of years ago, right before the blockade, that the Israeli state's intention was to, quote-unquote, put the people in Gaza on a diet. Clearly, they've been very, very clear that they want to use this as a very harsh blockade with full knowledge it was going to affect everyone in Gaza, not just Hamas or whoever it is that they're targeting. So these ships were loaded down with supplies and to get in to basically help people rebuild, get some supplies into the hospitals and get some food and other basic necessities into the people on the ground.
And how many ships were there in the flotilla?
I believe there were seven. I've heard reports of nine, but I'm pretty sure it was seven. And then I know that there's another one, the Rachel Corey actually is the name of it, that is supposed to be entering into or nearby Gaza sometime today. So there's at least eight total.
Was all of the main purported attack on just one ship?
The brunt of it did happen on the biggest ship that had the most people on it and the most supplies. And for everything I've said, certainly other ships were boarded and commandeered, and then they were all taken into the same Israeli port. But certainly all of the mayhem and death and certainly most of the violence appears to have just taken place on, I don't have the name in front of me, but it is certainly on the biggest ship in the flotilla that is basically the size of a full-size cruise ship.
Two aspects of this that got discussed in the Israeli media. One was that it was an ambush. Would you say that there's anything about this that qualifies as an ambush?
Absolutely not. This, if it was an ambush, it would have to be the worst ever ambush in history, because this was a flotilla that for months now has been advertising what it was going to do, specifically when it was going to sail. This was a flotilla that had multitudes of international media journalists on board, blogging, sending out TV reports, radio reports, en route, even while the Israeli raid and massacre took place. There's been no weapons found whatsoever by the Israeli authorities who are going through all the supplies. There's been no guns found, no bombs, any of this kind of nonsense, which, of course, you know, it's very clear. Turkish authorities themselves searched the ships. They're Turkish ships. All of them are, from what I have read. And of course, Turkey has been very, very clear that they had to clear the ships, make sure there were no weapons aboard, because otherwise their name would be tarnished. Plus, before this incident occurred, Turkey is the only predominantly Muslim country in the region that is an ally with Israel. So they didn't want to do anything to harm that. Of course, now that's been drugged through the dirt, and I certainly wouldn't say they're still an ally from the exchanges that have been going back and forth between the Turkish Prime Minister and Turkish ambassador to Israel and Israeli authorities. So certainly it's a flotilla that you know, there's no ambush, there's nothing like this. I mean, you know, to even respond to this is these claims that the state of Israel is making is absurd, because they're so over the top that they're kind of in this state of having to employ a desperate propaganda to try to justify this massacre.
Yesterday, you released an article that clearly demonstrated this isn't the first time we've encountered this. Can you tell us about the, or remind us, I should say, about the USS Liberty?
Right. Back on June 8, 1967, almost exactly 43 years ago, while sailing again in international waters in the Mediterranean Sea, there was a U.S. Navy intelligence ship called the USS Liberty. And it was attacked by air and naval forces of the state of Israel. The Liberty had a crew of 294. Of those, 34 were killed and more than 170 were wounded. It was an attack that went on for 90 minutes. I wrote this article because it really gives historical perspective on what Israel has just done with this flotilla. As blatant as this is, how much more blatant could they get than attacking a U.S. Navy intelligence ship, killing 34 seamen, wounding another 170 plus, and then getting away with it? This was an attack that went on 90 minutes. I interviewed several of the survivors of that attack for this article. One of them actually on three different occasions during the attack went up and raised the American flag, because the first two that he raised were shot off and riddled with bullets by the Israelis, but he raised a third so that they would not have an excuse and try to say that, well, they didn't know this was an American ship. It was torpedoed, it was attacked, it was strafed by aircraft. So this was a long attack, and when that ship radio for help to get reinforcements and get more American air power or sea power to come in and help, the help that was called in was then shut down by then Secretary of Defense McNamara. So we can go back and see this U.S. complicity with Israeli state terrorism goes all the way back to at least 1967, and that's even complicity when that Israeli state terrorism is directed directly at the U.S. military itself.
What has been the consequence of that after all these years? Pretty much it got buried diplomatically?
No consequence whatsoever, and that's another reason why I wrote the article, because these USS Liberty survivors have formed several different groups. The main one is the USS Liberty Veterans Association, and they have been pushing now for 43 years to try to get a real independent inquiry. They want justice. They want accountability. They want at least a formal apology by the U.S. government. And all of this has been for naught. They're not quitting. They're still finding new information. They're still getting lawyers. They're still trying to get it into the courts. They're still contacting their congressional reps, trying to get a new investigation. They're trying to get action into federal courts on this. But so far, it has resulted in nothing.
Well, I hope if you hear anything on that or on the flotilla, you'll join us again and give us an update. So thinking about the catastrophe we're seeing with BP, I want to look to another project that's been kind of percolating around in the conversation underneath, but perhaps really requires our attention. You've identified it as probably the largest industrial project in human history, and this would be the tar sands mining project in Alberta. Can you fill us in a little bit about this?
Right. The tar sands mining project, it's in Alberta, Canada. It's up, actually, it's pretty far north. It's up north of Edmonton. What the tar sands are is a very, very vast oil deposit. It's estimated that the higher estimates show 1.7 trillion barrels of oil, which is the equivalent to, actually, it's more than all the known oil reserves on the planet today. So we're talking about a massive amount of oil. But the reason why that is not the single biggest provider of oil for the U.S. and Canada and, you know, much of the rest of the world is because it's a very, very heavy, thick bitumen oil, and it just happens to be in a very sandy, shaley area, so that the extraction and refining process is extremely energy intensive. In fact, it's so energy intensive that one company had an idea of building a nuclear power plant up there to provide the energy necessary for this extraction process. So needless to say, with that information, we can understand that it's a very, very costly process, and it hasn't really there hasn't really been that much extraction happening at a very high rate until oil has gone up closer to the prices that we see today per barrel, up over $70 per barrel, because only then does it start to make a little bit of sense economically for these companies to go up there and spend massive amounts of energy and finance into extracting oil when actually it costs them more to extract it than they would actually profit or earn from selling it. But this is a massive project. It's being carried out by Imperial Oil, whose parent company is ExxonMobil Canada. And the pipelines for this project go all over Canada and all over the U.S. The U.S. will be the single biggest recipient of this oil. And it spans a massive, massive area up there. And the thing is, it's an extremely destructive process environmentally, because in order to extract this oil, they have to first take off the first 50 feet of the soil, and this is in pristine boreal forest up there, and just scrape that 50 feet of soil off, and then you're looking at this giant open pit where the tar sands and the oil are. They inject it with boiling water, sometimes other chemicals, to try to separate out the oil from the other material that it's in, and then of course suck it out and then refine it and then ship it out. So it's very, very environmentally destructive. Many groups up there, particularly First Nations peoples, are complaining of already suffering from some very severe health effects from it. So it's obviously a very, very controversial topic. Plus, the process of extracting this oil actually contributes three times more CO2, greenhouse gases, into the atmosphere than does normal oil extraction process.
Would you have a sense of the comparison between how the Canadian government handles its environmental laws and what we're obviously having a huge debate about here?
Yes, and everyone is, I think most people, I should say, understand that our country does not have the best environmental practices. I mean, we can look at, the regulations and such that they have just ignored and failed to apply to BP and numerous other rigs, either on or off the coast around this country. But as bad as our EPA is and our policies are, Canada's are actually worse. And, you know, a lot of people, and I used to assume assume this too, that Canada, given that there's this smaller population, most of the country is, it's so much beautiful country up there and wildlands, that they must have better environmental policies than us. But actually they don't. They actually have some of the worst environmental policies, of any Western country.
And what about prosecutions for violations, much like we've seen with BP and the Alaskan Slope, the Northern Slope? Do you know if Canada has a series of events like that that are notable?
They really don't. There's been, I noted in my piece that there was one incident, I believe it was back in 2007, when the Environmental Protection Agency of Canada issued an order against Suncor Energy, which is a tar sand exploiter, because they found them in with some infractions. But and there may be a few others like that, but nothing obviously that is deterring things from happening up there in the tar sands, or certainly nothing that's making it a more environmentally friendly extraction process.
So I want to move last bit for this week. I want to talk about the book you put out this last year and the article you had about the cultural cleansing of Iraq. Now, after the invasion of Iraq, it was well publicized, pilfering of the museum. But you said it wasn't really as random. It seems like it wasn't as random as it appeared on TV.
Definitely not. This was a situation where going in, I mean, it's a much longer conversation, but we have from research I've done and numerous other academics that contributed chapters to this book, that going in, there's so much that happened to basically destroy and disassemble the state of Iraq and the heritage there in academia, that it seems impossible to argue that this wasn't a deliberate, systematic plan to basically erase the Iraqi state and replace it with one that the U.S. Could basically fly in with a puppet government, which is what we've seen happen. So, the looting of the heritage sites and the museums that everyone saw during the invasion, and no effort made whatsoever, despite numerous warnings in advance from even American academics, hey, we need to go in there and preserve this. This is our world heritage. This is, the birthplace of Western civilization. We need to go and protect all these artifacts and art and history and literature and science. And that didn't happen. We can look at a very deliberate targeting, campaign targeting academics, where there's been, so far more than 400 academics across Iraq have been murdered or disappeared. And it's caused most of the rest of, professionals, whether they be academics or doctors or lawyers, to flee the country altogether. So, that's just a couple of aspects we cover in the book. I mentioned U.S.-backed death squads operating inside of Iraq with a lot of evidence to back that up as well. A very deliberate campaign to basically systematically disassemble and or destroy any Iraqi opposition, and certainly things that contribute directly to Iraqi nationalism. And this happened during the invasion itself, and then we saw it really start to pick up speed after the invasion, once the occupation settled in a bit and the U.S. really started to establish itself, and then it continues to this day.
Well, I'll get the book from you, read it over, and we'll have a further conversation on that. Now, last, I want to talk a little bit about independent journalism and the need to support independent journalism. Specifically, I want to ask the listeners to make sure that you support people like Dar, who have been doing hands-on reporting from the field. I remember seeing you here in Houston with the station, and you had a photo display along with very detailed stories that I don't get from CNN. I don't get it from Washington Post or New York Times or anyone. In fact, you're almost peerless in that way. Can you tell us a little bit about that work and the need to support it?
Well, independent journalism right now, I think, most people that try to follow the news on a regular basis understand that, mainstream journalism in this country is in a crisis. It's going away. It's in a crisis of legitimacy, one that it's brought about itself, and it really has left the door open for independent journalism, for both the need for it as well as the ability for folks like me to get out there and report on stories that either aren't being covered at all by the mainstream media or are being horribly misrepresented, whether we talk about Iraq or Afghanistan or the situation with the flotilla trying to break the siege of Gaza, or what's happening with BP right now in the Gulf of Mexico, which is actually my next area of coverage. I'll be flying out there in about, down to Louisiana in about 3 weeks or so to spend at least a few weeks, hopefully a bit more, covering the situation, how it's affecting the entire Gulf Coast region, the fishing industry, people who live along the coast, the ecosystems all inside the Gulf of Mexico and beside it. So very, very important information that we need to get out. We have to have this information, and the need for independent journalism today, I would argue confidently there's a greater need for it today than I think there ever has been. Of course, the problem folks like me run into is, you know, doing this and supporting ourselves in the process, because we don't have a big media company backing us up and flying us around to do our job. So I rely pretty heavily on donations from readers. So certainly, if I shamelessly plug my website, simply dahr.org, dahr.org, folks can go there and sign up and get free dispatches of what I'm writing about. And also, if they feel so inclined to support the work, they could actually donate there as well, and it would be much appreciated.
And did you know the two journalists who were killed in Iraq, or had you met them before? Saeed Shamagh and Nimir Nur al-Din, the two Reuters photographers who were killed?
Oh, in the WikiLeaks video? Yes. No, I did not know them.
Because when I saw them, I thought of you and a bunch of people I know who have gone and done this work. So in a way, they are brothers, whether we ever met them or not.
That's true. And, you know, I do know others that have been detained, and I do know some others that have been killed. And, right. And that's right. And it's very, whenever we see a journalist anywhere being killed or have horrible things happen to them, like you said, it's shocking, and it certainly affects us all.
Well, I thank you for all the work you've been doing. And again, I want the listeners to go to your website. We'll provide a link for everyone. And come back and join us sometime.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, brother. See you soon.
Take care.
Next up, a discussion with retired Brigadier General David Irvin on George Bush's admission to authorizing waterboarding and the consequences of his actions. Yeah, so if you have some comments, I'd like to hear what you have to say about the revelations from Mr. Bush, and also, will it matter whether or not this was said without a recording in either audio or video form?
Well, I didn't hear the original audio. I was responding yesterday to a news report that indicated this is what former President Bush had said. So I need to qualify my response yesterday with the observation that I did not hear him say that. And I'm assuming that that was an accurate transcription of his remarks. If it was an accurate transcription, then everything I commented, I absolutely stand behind.
So in light of the comment from Mr. Bush and from former Vice President Cheney in December of 2008, where does that put us now?
Well, as far as the nation presently is concerned, the current president has made it very clear that the law is what it has always been, that we as a nation do not authorize nor sanction torture of any individual by any officer or employee of the federal government. The great effort that was made during the last administration to skirt that federal law, I think, was a dismal failure, and certainly in terms of what it accomplished, it created far more problems for the nation and for its security than it ever could possibly have ameliorated.
And what, for instance, I'm aware that if Mr. Obama and or Mr. Holder do not seek to prosecute the highest ranking officials who were involved in war crimes, would that not in itself be a war crime?
Well, waterboarding has always been a war crime, and I think this is the first time that I'm aware of that there has been an acknowledgement from the former president that he himself authorized these procedures. I may have missed something somewhere along the years, but I think he has been a little careful in the past about his comments with respect to that practice. So in terms of what this means in terms of any legal implications for any individual, I doubt that it's going to change the policy of we will not look back. That has been the case since the previous administration left office.
And what about internationally?
Well, internationally, I think those who were critical of the United States and its torture policies 5 years ago will continue to remain critical of the former president, perhaps more so for having brought the subject back up again after it was probably considered something of a dead issue by many, many people. And I think that there are a number of individuals who probably should be a little bit careful about where they travel now, and perhaps Mr. Bush has added his name to that list if it was not already there.
And that would probably include Italy as an example?
Any nation that that might take its responsibilities under the anti-torture conventions or the Geneva conventions seriously, because they, all of the signatories to those treaties have an obligation to prosecute war crimes where they are aware of them. And comments like the one yesterday don't make it easier for nations to continue to wink and nod at what has happened.
And last question for you, based on your position in the military before you retired. When did you retire, by the way?
I retired in 2002.
2002. So how does this basically a civilian administration wanting to engage in torture, how does that affect like the esprit de corps for you and other? I mean, you were out of the service at that point when pretty much right before we even caught these folks that we were going to have tortured. But what's your sense of what that does throughout rank and file all the way down?
Well, first of all, it sends a mixed message to the rank and file. When there is a statement from the president or the vice president that torture is acceptable under any circumstances, that zings down through the ranks and becomes accepted as a declaration of official policy. And it's very difficult for military leaders to walk that process back and make it clear that soldiers are expected to follow the laws of war. The laws of war do not accept torture as a permissible practice. The other thing that it does is put our troops in greater danger. We have just concluded a session in Philadelphia where about 15 retired admirals and generals were together. This is the same group that has been speaking out about these issues since about 2005. And one of our number is a retired Army Major General Paul Eaton, who was responsible while he was in Iraq for training up Iraqi security forces. And he shares a story that ought to be pretty sobering. The day after the photos at Abu Ghraib appeared in the Arab press, his deputy, who was an Iraqi Brigadier Air Force officer under Saddam Hussein, walked into General Eaton's office and said, "General, you have no idea how serious this issue is or how damaging these photographs are to what you are trying to do and what we are trying to do, because they will be unforgivable in the Arab street. And General Eaton is pretty dramatic in his description of how, from that day forward, life in his sector of Iraq became far more dangerous for Americans, far more dangerous for the Iraqis who were cooperating with the Americans than it had been previously. And it's that kind of threat that we're concerned about. We're obligated to follow the Geneva Conventions in our treatment of prisoners. And we're obligated to follow those conventions in Afghanistan. We're obligated to follow those conventions in Iraq. When we do not, we send a strong message to the rest of the world that they are free to treat American service personnel exactly the way we treat citizens of those countries who come into our custody. And that can be very, very dangerous for our folks.
Strategically also, does it not waste, aside from the lives lost both in civilian terms and in a military service personnel, but does it not also potentially create a huge waste of time when you have people giving you white noise?
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear that last statement.
When you have a system that is not based in divining what is so, what is true, instead you have a system to reinforce policy, a reason for invading, an ongoing justified campaign of occupation. When these are the motivations as opposed to finding out who is actually working with whom and on what level and whether they're the good guys or the bad guys. I mean, intelligence, you taught interrogation, for instance.
Yes, I understand your question. And you raise an excellent issue. The whole purpose of interrogation is to get to the truth. And when we abandoned the principles of humane treatment of prisoners in our search for information, we got all kinds of information that was unverifiable or that in many cases was simply false. And there is so much evidence based on past history, our own and the history of other nations as well, that torture does not produce reliable intelligence, that it is absolutely shocking to professional interrogators or investigators that we would ever have marched down that path. And we went to war in Iraq in large measure based upon the faulty and incorrect information that one particular individual deliberately gave his Egyptian interrogators, who were functioning at our request to obtain information from him, and to save his life, he told the Egyptians exactly what he thought we wanted to hear. It was false. We relied upon it. And he later recanted and said, hey, I said what I said because if I didn't say it, they were going to kill me. That's the kind of information you get when you rely on torture as an expedient instead of a methodical, strategically planned interrogation that operates on the accepted principles of questioning and international law.
And you're solid to the point that there is no such ticking time bomb scenario that ever requires anything beyond what is professionally applied through professional level interrogation. And I'll leave it at that best terminology.
There are real live ticking time bombs every day in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Israel, for example, and soldiers on the ground have to deal with those. Every platoon leader in a hostile environment faces a potential ticking time bomb every day. If we grant authority to the President of the United States to make a decision as the circumstances seem to warrant, we cannot control the compulsion or the invitation that will be felt down through the ranks by soldiers at all levels as they deal with those real live ticking time bombs to make a similar decision that they are free to go off the reservation and employ whatever means they feel necessary to get the information they think will save their soldiers. The problem is that for most of us, when we talk about the ticking time bomb in a strategic scenario, we are thinking about a set of circumstances that simply do not exist. There just are not situations where we find someone who knows where there is going to be an atomic device that goes off in the middle of Times Square in 30 minutes. We just don't get that kind of information from people, and those circumstances exist on television, not in reality.
And you, along with others, have approached, for instance, one of the most prominent shows, a show that people around my quarters, we refer to that as Cheney porn. That's our term for that show and other shows like it. But you've approached these shows, or others have approached these shows, and said it's not beneficial or it needs to stop.
Well, the sad thing about the television show 24, which is great entertainment, I suppose, if you like that sort of thing, is that it literally became the honest-to-gosh basis for formulating American policy in Guantanamo. And if you look at the history of how we got where we are, the decision to march down the torture road by the United States was made by a handful of individuals, not more than about 10. None of those guys had any experience in the military. None of them had any experience in law enforcement. None of them had any experience as interrogators. They relied on information that was of 24, and they figured if it worked for Jack Bauer, it would work for us as a nation, and they were dead wrong.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. I hope you'll come back, and we'll have an extended conversation on some other topics, but it's been great to hear your input on this, and especially feedback related to the comments of former President George W. Bush.
Thank you very much.